It's a pleasure to introduce today Dr. William Walker, who's a professor and associate chair of clinical care in the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. He is the senior scientific director of the DivVic Brain Center at the McGuire VA&C in Richmond, in addition, a principal investigator for the chronic effects of neurotrauma, the longitudinal study. He has great experience in this area, and we're looking forward to this important clinical presentation. Bill?
Yes, hi everyone, and thank you, Dr. De Palma. I got to know Dr. De Palma through our CINCE grant, Chronic Effects of Neurotrauma Consortium. He is on the Government Steering Committee, and through those interactions, we were having discussions about some of the challenges in diagnosing mild traumatic brain injury and how we were handling those in our project, which actually spun off of how I handle it in my clinical practice. What we're going to be going over here today is some of the nuances involved in clinical diagnosis. Dr. Cifu, it did polytrauma grand rounds last week for those of you who were able to join in that seminar, webinar, and he mentioned how simple it was to diagnose mild traumatic brain injury. And what he was referring to was the process. It's a simple process, but there are some significant subtleties and complicating factors which can make it difficult to come up with a definitive diagnosis. And so that's what I'm going to be drilling in on today, how we do it in CINCE, which again is sort of relates to how I approach it clinically as well. The specific learning objectives to understand the challenges and necessary elements to make a valid mild traumatic brain injury diagnosis, to differentiate that from post-concussion syndrome or residual effects of a TBI, and to describe the methodology that we've been using to diagnose one's lifetime mild traumatic brain injuries and how to apply this to clinical practice as well. So just to kind of get a handle on who is listening in here, what my audience is, I wanted to get some feedback on your primary role. So, Molly, is there anything I need to do on this poll question?
No, you are all set. So for our attendees, the poll question is up on your screen now. So go ahead and select what your primary role in VA is. We understand that many of you probably wear many hats within the organization. So just go ahead and select your primary role there. And it looks like we've got a nice responsive audience. 75% have already chimed in. So we'll give people a few more seconds. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this out and share those results. Looks like 5% of our respondents selected student trainee or fellow, 34% clinician, 33% researcher, 10% administrator, manager, or policymaker, and 19% selected other. For those of you that selected other, please note that I will have a feedback survey at the end of the session with a longer list of job titles, so you might find your exact one there to select. So thank you to our respondents. Dr. Walker, do you have any commentary on that, or would you like me to move
on? No, and just the follow-up question to that, if you do have a clinical role or any clinical background or training, what area is that in, which is the next poll question. So yeah. It sounds like that we have a mix of audience in terms of their role with the VA.
Very much so. So for our attendees, the second poll question is up on your screen, again, which best describes your clinical role with regards to mild TBI. The answer selections are first responder or emergency department, primary care, neurology or rehabilitation, neuropsychologic care or assessments, or other. And we'll give people a little bit more time to respond. Okay, it looks like about 60% have responded and answers have stopped coming in. So I'm going to go ahead and close that and share those results. 3% selected primary care, 33% neurology or rehabilitation, 16% neuropsychologic care or assessments, and just about half selected other. So thank you again to those respondents. And Dr. Walker, I will give you the screen share once again.
Okay, excellent. Thanks, everyone. So one of the reasons we're talking about this is because of the high incidence of TBI. The actual true prevalence of mild traumatic brain injury is difficult to determine because many individuals don't actually seek medical attention. And even if they do, it may not be well documented. The TBI may not be well documented. More recently, there's been increased interest in TBI because of the possible link with chronic traumatic encephalopathy. I'm not sure if my slide animations are working here correctly.
Yep, they are.
Okay.
I believe so, unless more should be popping up on
No.
I'm sorry, I don't have the slides, Molly. Do we have the slides on?
Yeah, the slides are on. But if anything should be popping up other than the text that's already there, we aren't seeing that.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's okay. I was going to more recently, there's been an increased interest in chronic traumatic encephalopathy. The actual phenomenon is not new. There's just been an increased interest. It's been long known that pugilistic dementia exists in boxers who have had dozens and dozens of mild traumatic brain injuries. But there's been increasing concern about not only football players developing it, but also our service members and veterans. What we do know to date is there is no evidence at all that a single concussion leads to CTE, whether or not repeated concussions, and if so, how many lead to CTE, remains under active investigation. And unfortunately, we don't have any answers at this point, but that question is one of the main reasons for the CINCI project, which I mentioned that we're involved with. So other than it being extremely common, why is mild TBI a concern then? About 20%, according to the literature, do not fully recover within the typical time frame of acute recovery, which is sort of arbitrarily set at 3 months. The ICD criteria for post-concussive syndrome is a persistence of TBI-like symptoms for at least 3 months after the event. There's still a lot of controversy regarding how often clinical post-concussion syndrome is actually a true TBI effect versus symptom misattribution. So the literature really is not settled on this. When you have a diagnosis that's named a syndrome, typically there's going to be some controversy similar to fibromyalgia syndrome. So there's still a lot we do not know about why some people seem to have this clinical problem persisting. When they are present, however, when problems are present, their difficulties are very similar to much more severe traumatic brain injuries. And oddly, in some patients, are even more bothersome. So we can have mild traumatic brain injury patients who are much more symptomatic than very severe traumatic brain injuries with major problems in their life functioning. Whether or not it elevates the risk of CTE, as I mentioned, there is actually no evidence that a single one leads to CTE. And the question of a link to repetitive TBI is under active investigation. For the VA definition, one of the things that Dr. DePalma and I were discussing was how this all relates to the VA screen. The VA actual definition for TBI contains these elements, which I'm going to be going through in a little bit of detail in the ensuing slides, but includes an alteration of consciousness and a traumatic force strong enough to cause that altered consciousness. The clinical practice guidelines provides a little bit of insight into what that means, altered consciousness. So the diagnostic criteria themselves do not really provide operational definitions. Within the practice guidelines, they talk about typical exam findings, which means someone looks dazed, dazed, confused, disoriented, difficulty responding to mental status questions, being unable to describe events immediately before or after the traumatic event. So if you're examining the patient during a period, you should be able to pick it up. Symptoms at this time include feeling dazed or uncertain what's going on, feeling confused, or having difficulty thinking clearly. What makes it difficult is the diagnostic criteria and the CPG do not provide any guidance on differentiating these altered consciousness signs and symptoms from potential alternative causes. In a fear response, which is driven by an autonomic nervous system overdrive, the ability to think and reason decreases. Some people even have feelings of time slowing down, tunnel vision, feeling like what's happening is not real. So these are very similar to those altered consciousness symptoms with traumatic brain injury. Furthermore, acute stress reaction has many symptoms as well, which include narrowing of attention and disorientation. So difficult to disentangle this from a traumatic brain injury, altered consciousness symptoms. Besides the diagnosis of the TBI, there's a set of early symptoms which can be seen, the early effects of a concussion, including somatic, cognitive, and emotional symptoms. Somatic symptoms include headache, dizziness, tinnitus, photophobia, visual disturbance, cognitive symptoms like forgetful, word-finding difficulties, concentration problems, slow thinking, emotional symptoms, irritability being the most common, but also mood abnormalities as well, including labile mood. The examination findings, however, are generally subtle and confined to either oculomotor findings or vestibular findings. Vestibular findings are on standard exam are best picked up by checking tandem gait. Oculomotor findings most commonly involve reduced eye convergence. These findings are generally subtle, and unless you're evaluating the person very soon after the incident, you're probably not going to find any gross abnormalities. There's been a recent interest in vestibular ocular motor testing, which has been touted as having a diagnostic role, but to date, there's really no good evidence that it should be used in a diagnostic role. The findings may not be specific to TBI, and it also may not be sensitive. As I said, these findings typically wear off fairly quickly after a mild TBI. In terms of any of these early effects, they're really not necessary for the diagnosis. The diagnosis can be made on the traumatic event and that immediate alteration of consciousness. Any other early effects of the TBI are really only used as supportive evidence for the diagnosis. When early effects do not wear away, they become late effects. I mentioned post-concussion syndrome, which is simply the persistence of these effects beyond that three-month time frame. Exam findings at this stage are almost always non-existent. Clinically, the people that I see in my clinical practice who have any findings are typically those who have psychological overlay to their exam. So what I would term a functional post-concussion syndrome with exaggerated fluttering of the eyes during extraocular motion testing, sort of purposeful wavering of or purposely very slow and laborious finger-nose finger testing, sometimes aphysiologic stuttering or aphysiologic stumbling of gait. So these sort of psychological overlay to the exam. Very rarely are you going to see actually any clear-cut true neurologic abnormalities in the late stage of mild TBI. They have, in terms of the diagnosis of the putative TBI, they have no role. And I mentioned the diagnostic criteria for post-concussion syndrome, which does require having initially had a TBI. So these symptoms are not specific for traumatic brain injury, and certainly many of these vague symptoms, somatic cognitive emotional symptoms, are common in the population at large. But to be post-concussion syndrome, they need to have begun after a positive TBI diagnosis and then persisted. So in terms of the VA TBI screen and how this relates to that, the VA screen has four elements, the traumatic event, the altered consciousness immediately after event, which actually is what screens for a TBI diagnosis. And then the next item is the early effects. It asks about TBI symptoms right after the event. Then the fourth is any ongoing or persisting effects, asking for recent symptoms, TBI-like symptoms. So the VA screen requires all four of those elements. So it's really not intended to screen for any past TBI, because if someone has no active symptoms, then any historical TBI they had will screen as negative. Instead, it really screens for possible late effects of a possible TBI in the past. So if you were to just take the first two elements, that is a screen for any past TBI. The Department of Defense in the post-deployment health reassessment has a very similar TBI screen, which includes the exact same elements, the traumatic event, the altered consciousness symptoms, then early effects and then late effects, and similar to the VA, requires all four questions to be positive. So again, the role of these screening is really to look for someone with possible chronic post-concussion syndrome. All right, so now to review this material, I'm going to pose an audience poll question here. So if I can have Molly share that.
No problem. So for attendees, as you can see on your screen, we do have the final poll question up. I'm sorry, not the final one, but we have a poll question up. Go ahead and respond to that. Okay, so this is one where you can select all that apply. So along with sufficiently traumatic force to the head, which of the following symptoms can alone be diagnostic for mild TBI? Memory gap of impact and immediate aftermath, headache immediately after impact, traumatic intracranial hemorrhage on head CT, dazed and confused for several minutes after impact, or memory gap for the week before the event. And it looks like had just over 60% respond. We'll give people a few more seconds. All right, it looks like we've capped off at around two-thirds of our audience replying. So I'm going to go ahead and close that and share the results. 64% selected memory gap of impact and immediate aftermath, 30% headache immediately after impact, 27% traumatic intracranial hemorrhage on head CT, 70% dazed and confused for several minutes after impact, and 18% memory gap for the week before the event. So thank you to those respondents. And I will give you back the screen share now.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, everyone. So one of the reasons I had this question early in the talk is to see I have a very similar question towards the end to see if I'm effective as a teacher. So hopefully the answers will improve on the last time, but the correct items would have been A and D. So A essentially describes post-traumatic amnesia. So that is like the clinical hallmark of traumatic brain injury. For B, headache is a possible early effect. Headache can be from head injury alone without TBI. It can also be from post-traumatic stress disorder. Headache is common. It can be used as supportive criteria for the diagnosis. But unless you have initial alteration of consciousness, it does not diagnose a TBI. The choice C would essentially be something worse than a mild TBI. So by definition, a mild TBI has a normal head CT. So if there's any traumatic bleeding on head CT, then it's more than a mild TBI. It's either a moderate or severe traumatic brain injury. So D is similar to memory gap. It's a sign of altered consciousness immediately after impact. For F, is a memory gap before the event is retrograde amnesia. And I didn't really go over this yet, but again, I wanted to have this in here early to explain the difference between retrograde and antegrade amnesia. With traumatic brain injury, the period of retrograde amnesia is always considerably shorter than antegrade amnesia. And for very mild brain injuries, it's rare to actually get any significant retrograde amnesia. So even for very severe traumatic brain injuries who may have four weeks or more of post-traumatic amnesia, the retrograde amnesia, the loss of memory from before the event, is much, much shorter and would be rare to even see a week of retrograde amnesia after severe TBI. So something like this would be more consistent with psychogenic amnesia, where you'd have a very long period before the injury. Okay, so hopefully my slide screen's back up, but I want to move into the evaluation and distinguish between whether or not one's evaluating immediately or whether it's a delayed evaluation. So with immediate evaluation during altered consciousness, it actually is fairly easy to diagnose. So if you're on the sidelines or you're in the battlefield and able to witness the event and immediately examine someone, there's a number of validated structured symptom measures as well as mental status examinations as well as some other clinical tools to help diagnose it. So it's actually fairly straightforward, but the majority of the time we're in the situation of a delayed evaluation. So even if the evaluation is delayed by an hour, you're unlikely to see that altered consciousness express itself clinically, and it's almost entirely based on self-report. Getting back to the diagnostic criteria, that altered consciousness is really key to making the diagnosis. It's the clinical hallmark of diffuse axonal injury, which is the primary pathology in traumatic brain injury. Post-traumatic amnesia and frank loss of consciousness are clinical phenomena across that altered consciousness spectrum. The longer the post-traumatic amnesia, the more the severe the traumatic brain injury. So we define moderate traumatic brain injury is post-traumatic amnesia of 24 hours or more, and severe traumatic brain injury is post-traumatic amnesia a week or more. Even within severe traumatic brain injury, 2 weeks of post-traumatic amnesia has poorer outcomes than 1 week. 4 weeks has poorer outcome than 2 weeks and so on. There's almost a linear relationship between the duration of post-traumatic amnesia and outcome prognosis. It's rarely a diagnostic challenge in more severe traumatic brain injury. As I said, if someone's frankly confused, it's going to last for at least a week. They may have a period of being in a coma as well. In mild traumatic amnesia, identifying that initial alteration of consciousness can be difficult simply, as I've mentioned, it's because that period can be so brief. It can be as brief as several minutes. When you have a situation of delayed evaluation, there's a number of potential sources which you can utilize to show that evidence of that altered consciousness. You may have documentation of first responders or emergency department providers. You may have a witness. Lacking those, it boils down to self-report. And we're going to kind of go through these various ways you can elicit self-report. In terms of early documentation, obvious advantages compared to history later on, it's relatively objective. Particularly if it's performed, as I mentioned, during that altered consciousness period. So if it's sideline, if it's EMS personnel, first responder personnel, that's going to be your best objective evidence. Even that is not foolproof unless that frank confusion is directly observed. The information needed may not be captured. It's also heavily dependent on the bias and expertise and skill of whoever's doing the assessment and how quickly after the event it's done. A witness report can be considered a type of early assessment. I'm going to be describing the results of that study shown there at the bottom of the slide a little bit later in more detail. For self-report, questionnaire format is the simplest. That's got the advantages of being efficient. It can be done remotely, unbiased. Disadvantages are sensitivity and specificity depend on the instrument. It also depends on how prevalent the condition is in the population that you're applying it to. Most importantly, if you get responses on the questionnaire which don't make sense, you have no way of working through that. For unstructured interview, this is really the standard clinical approach. The problem is what strategy is the best, and it also has significant disadvantages for research use particularly. Interviewers, clinical personnel can be biased. If you look at the data on the second level TBI evaluations across the polytrauma sites, you will see a wide variety of prevalence of positive diagnoses ranging widely from 30% at perhaps one site to 80% at another. So there's huge variability when you leave it to clinicians to make a clinical judgment. And so this is a big problem for research use of a unstructured clinical interview. So in the right hands, it's probably the best way, but very problematic in terms of generalizing it. The structured interview has advantages of better standardization, less bias, better reliability. Disadvantages are it's less efficient, and what tools are available. So for mental health diagnosis, structured interviews are really considered the gold standard for making diagnoses in research. The SCID, the CAPS, other structured interviews available. There's not a lot available for traumatic brain injury. So I'm going to briefly run through what is available for mild traumatic brain injury. So for the early documentation. This was that study I referred to early. They went and did a research interview with participants as they were going through the emergency department. Then they compared their interview to what was documented in the records, and they found a 56% false negative rate. In other words, over half of the TBIs that they diagnosed were not actually documented in the emergency department note. Anecdotally, I can tell you that there's false positives commonly as well. One of the more rewarding things I do as a clinician is seeing an individual from follow-up from the emergency department or perhaps a brief trauma hospitalization and telling them that they actually did not have a TBI when they may have been told otherwise at the hospital. For witness report is really second best. Unfortunately, obviously, we have no data to say how reliable that is. And oftentimes when we're evaluating the patient, we don't actually have that witness there. So we're really asking the patient what they were told by the witness. So absent that, we're really left with self-report, as I mentioned. Questionnaires, questionnaires are really designed as screening tools. So this would be kind of like using the PCL to diagnose PTSD. The interview process has limited psychometric data available, and we really don't know what interview is the best. So these are some of the interviews that have been described in the literature, the brief traumatic brain injury screen. This was really compared, was a questionnaire that was compared with an unstructured interview. This study, unfortunately, doesn't really go a long way. So I haven't really seen this reproduced much in the literature, this particular screen. So you may not even have heard of this. But I'm just showing you what's available in the literature. This particular instrument, the OSU TBI ID, is probably the most used by researchers. Unfortunately, if you look at the psychometric data, the diagnostic accuracy is really not demonstrated for mild traumatic brain injury. It was really developed more for moderate and severe traumatic brain injury identification. We do use this instrument, a variation of it, to screen for possible past mild TBIs. The process we use, we call potential concussive event mapping. So we look for any possible TBI during their life, but we do not use this instrument to diagnose the TBI. We just use it to identify possible TBIs that we then do follow-up interviewing on to determine the diagnosis. This is another instrument that has been described. I haven't seen it used a lot in the literature, but see, did not really have very good agreement inter-rater reliability. So how is Sensi addressing these challenges? So we screen for all lifetime potential events using the OSU TBI ID. Then for each of those events we identify, we use a structured interview that we published a few years ago. This data on that publication was from a cohort of blast-exposed individuals. So using that instrument, we do a fully structured interview along with an open-ended component. With a fully structured component, there's actually an algorithm diagnosis, a preliminary diagnosis that's generated. And then the investigator reviews the open-ended interview component and compares it against that and makes a determination about whether things match up and the algorithm is correct, or if something does not match up, in which case the free text information may be compelling that the algorithm is wrong, If there's any question, they do additional unstructured interview. And the final level is a referral to a central diagnosis committee if there's still some doubt about the diagnosis. So some of this will become clear as we move through the next set of slides into how all this plays out. So I'm just going to be going through each of these criteria, diagnostic criteria. So first of all, the traumatic force. So our interview asked the patient to describe the event, and this is verbatim how we asked for it, and I'm not going to go through this in detail. But essentially, this is just looking for was there a traumatic force to the head. Then the next step is that open-ended interview component. So here you're simply trying to elicit a free text response, a description of what they felt with the event and immediately after. So this is typically how I would start a clinical interview. Just asking them what they remember and what they felt. So this information is collected and then used, like I said, to compare with the structured interview, just as a validity check. The structured interview starts with probing for the post-traumatic amnesia. As I mentioned before, antegrade amnesia is always significantly longer than retrograde amnesia with a TBI. TBI can cause antegrade amnesia without retrograde amnesia, but not the opposite. Sometimes there's a chain of actual impacts. So a person, for example, a car might strike a guardrail and then collide into a tree. So an individual may remember the first impact, but not the second. So sometimes you have to sort that out where there's a series of impacts. Generally speaking, if someone remembers the event, then the chance of them having any post-traumatic amnesia is pretty low. And if they do have any post-traumatic amnesia, it's going to be pretty brief. So the pattern that would be most consistent with a TBI, with a mild TBI, is lack of remembering the event and then a memory gap of a little while after the event, the post-traumatic amnesia. So this is specifically how the questions are asked in our interview, and I'm not going to go through this line by line, but the slides there are available for you. So those are simply scripts and to help directly get at each of those items. After the series of questions about post-traumatic amnesia is asked, then the next step is to make sure that you're not missing anything. So if someone remembers the event, denies a lack of memory beforehand, denies a lack of memory afterhand, then they should have continuous memory. And so then you would just follow up and ask just to make certain there's no holes or gaps in the memory. So the purpose of this is a sensitivity check, okay? So the moderate to severe TBI literature shows that PTA duration is really the most important indicator of prognosis, as I mentioned. So it stands to reason that having the absence or presence of post-traumatic amnesia is really an important distinction for mild TBI. If you do diagnose post-traumatic amnesia, our algorithm actually separates that in terms of a diagnosis of TBI with or a TBI without post-traumatic amnesia. So the algorithm in the CDI not only comes up with a TBI yes versus no, but if a TBI positive diagnosis is made, it separates it into with post-traumatic amnesia versus without post-traumatic amnesia. If someone has post-traumatic amnesia, they may also have a period of frank loss of consciousness. Many individuals self-report of loss of when actually what they're saying is they have a period of time they don't remember. So being unconscious is not a state that can be remembered. So it's important to give them the definition in case they don't understand the concept. And it's also important to ask how they determined it, since it cannot be remembered. So we handle witnessed loss of consciousness much differently than a self-report of loss of consciousness. Either way, it's important to ask for how long they were unconscious. One of the severity indicators for TBI is duration of unconsciousness. So, as I mentioned, self-determined loss of consciousness usually indicates a gap in memory. It may or may not indicate they were actually unconscious. A witness verified immediate loss of consciousness in the context of a traumatic force is almost always rules in TBI. Okay, so going through this process, clinically, if by now someone has indicated, if I've determined someone has post-traumatic amnesia, I actually do not need to do any more in terms of the diagnostic interview. I can move into what problems may you currently be having, what residual effects may you be having from the TBI. However, if a person was not unconscious, if they did not have post-traumatic amnesia, then the diagnosis boils down to these softer symptoms. Did the individual feel dazed, confused, or see stars right afterwards? If they did, how long? Sometimes the duration can help you differentiate from a stress or fear reaction. So a period of being dazed for seconds and then being able to perform other tasks, whether it's getting on the phone calling for help, whether it's getting back into the heat of the battle, that would more indicate not a TBI. With the dazed and confused, however, lasted 5-10 minutes, if initially they felt foggy and were really unable to think or clearly act or perform, then that would more indicate that it was an actual TBI cause. So those are just some of the ways you would try to determine whether or not that softer altered consciousness symptom was from a TBI or an alternative cause. All right, so for the TBI diagnosis, you must have immediate alteration of consciousness. This is determined by mental status during altered consciousness window or interview after that window, either by witness-corroborated LOC, a memory gap consistent with TBI physiology, or altered consciousness symptoms compatible with TBI physiology. Some data that we used in our prior study where we had TBI experts grade the interview information on likelihood of TBI, these experts felt that dazed was the least specific for TBI, and that saw seeing stars was more specific for TBI. So in our diagnostic algorithm, if someone is dazed alone without any other corroborating symptoms like being confused, having their bell rung, et cetera, then it's less likely to be a TBI cause. Okay, so I'm going to turn it back over to an audience poll question here, and we're getting close to the end, so I think we should end up on time. So.
Thank you. So for our attendees, you do have the fourth poll question up on your screen. So immediately after a traumatic event, feeling dazed for a minute or less could be due to TBI, acute stress reaction, fear response, or D, all of the above. Go ahead and click the circle. And we'll give people just a little bit more time. All right, looks like we've got a Nice response rate. So I'm going to close that out and share those results. 7% selected TBI, 3% acute stress reaction, 3% fear response, and 87% all of the above.
All right. Excellent. Yes, all of the above. So maybe my teaching is coming along. So, all right. If I had put in there days for 10 minutes or more, that would have made it more likely to be TBI. Very difficult. If you have very, very brief days symptoms, very difficult to distinguish any of these apart. All right, so one of the things just to highlight again that this is CDC criteria for mild TBI specifically states that any of those post-injury symptoms, i.e. the early effects, headache, dizziness, irritability, et cetera, they can only be used to support but cannot be used to make the diagnosis of mild TBI. Because though they can be supportive, they can add to the database in terms of diagnoses one way or the other, but not by themselves. We do ask these questions in our structured interview. One thing to note about headache, the ICD criteria for post-traumatic headache is headache occurring within 2 weeks of a traumatic brain injury, and so that's why we have that two-week question in here that you see. Other symptoms we just leave as pretext, so we just try to elicit any other symptoms without trying to lead them down the road of specifically asking for all those other symptoms like tinnitus, difficulty concentrating, et cetera. So we'd like to just see their, open-ended response to that. All right, so back to a poll question. Headache after a traumatic event may be due to.
Thank you. So for our attendees, you do have that fifth poll question up on your screen, and you can go ahead and select TBI, PTSD, cervical whiplash, none of the above, or all of the above. Go ahead and take a moment to review those answer options. All right, looks like I see a pretty strong trend here of the responses. So I'm going to go ahead and close this out now, share those results. 19% selected TBI, 1% PTSD, 3% cervical whiplash, 1% none of the above, and 76% all of the above.
All right, it is the most common somatic symptom after TBI, but it is not specific for TBI. Headache is extremely common with cervical whiplash injury. It's also extremely common with PTSD. There's a whole literature out there on cervical whiplash associated headaches, so-called cervicogenic headaches. With a cervical whiplash, you can also get head injury causing soft tissue injury to the scalp or even a skull contusion as well. The extent of headaches with PTSD is probably under-recognized. It's extremely common. As a last part of our structured interview, we're just looking for if the individual was evaluated anywhere initially. Assuming we can't find any information in their current medical record, we only utilize this to see if there's a way we can search for any of that early documentation. It also can help you in terms of understanding the severity if they were admitted to the hospital and for how long, particularly if you're trying to distinguish mild TBI from more severe traumatic brain injury. Okay, so this back to a poll question, which is very similar to the early one. So we'll see what sort of headway we made here with my material.
Thank you. So along with a sufficiently traumatic force to the head, which of the following symptoms can be diagnostic for mild TBI by itself? Memory gap of impact and immediate aftermath, dizziness and tinnitus immediately after impact, traumatic intracranial hemorrhage on head CT, dazed and confused for several minutes after impact, or memory gap for the week before the event. While I wait for the responses to come in, Dr. Walker, can you correct me? Is it tinnitus or tinnitus? I've heard it both ways.
I've heard it both ways as well. I use tinnitus.
Okay.
You say tomato, I say tomato. Yeah, I think either is fine.
All right, so we'll give people a few more seconds to get their replies in. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this out and share the final results. 81% selected memory gap of impact and immediate aftermath. 21% dizziness and tinnitus immediately after impact. 6% traumatic intracranial hemorrhage on head CT. 70% dazed and confused for several minutes after impact. And 4% memory gap for the week
All right.
before the event.
Very good. We did make some headway. It was A and D are the correct answers. So tinnitus and dizziness are very common after TBI, but by themselves cannot be used to make a diagnosis. You've got to have a component of initial alteration of consciousness, either loss of consciousness, post-traumatic amnesia, or a softer altered consciousness, signs and symptoms like feeling dazed, confused for at least a few minutes. All right, so just wrapping up here, this is a summary of the order of the elements of the interview. What, in terms of our experience with the actual embedded algorithm, we found that it's pretty good, but not foolproof. The most common reasons that the algorithm comes out with something that looks wrong is since instances where there might have been a syncopal spell, the individual may have been intoxicated or asleep at the time of the event. So these can further confound the elements of the structured interview and the outcome of the algorithm. So these are the most common scenarios where we actually have to override the algorithm. The other times it may need to be overridden is based on the duration of those dazed or confused symptoms, depending on how brief or long they are. And I kind of already mentioned that. So to wrap up, I'm going to show you a video here, if we can get it to play. We'll see how this goes. I never trust these videos. Let's see. It looks like it's loading. The point of this is to say that even when directly witnessed, experts may not accurately diagnose a mild traumatic brain injury. So you can see a sack, head getting slammed. Now watch him try to get up. Whoops. All right. A little wobbly. His offensive lineman's trying to help him. All right. So this incident actually prompted another revision. There's been multiple revisions of the NFL concussion evaluation protocol because this was missed. And he stayed in the game. And as you see, as the video goes along, they'll show you what happened on the next play after he stayed in. Whoops. So clearly he's altered, right? So if you're evaluating him like immediately at this immediate point, if you run out on the field, I'm sure you could pick up him being altered, okay? However, if you were seeing him an hour later, let's say this was a sandlot game, and the individual showed up and you're in the emergency department, you may, by that time, he may no longer be altered, and then the diagnosis would be strictly based on self-report at that time. So you'd be asking him, okay, what, is there a period of time? Did he actually remember getting slammed to the ground? Did he remember this? The next play, he turned the ball over because obviously he's neurologically altered. So with that, we'll wrap up here. And if there's time for questions, I'm happy to entertain any. Thank you.
Thank you. We do have some pending questions from the audience. If you joined us after the top of the hour and are looking to submit a question or comment, you can do so using the GoToWebinar control panel on the right-hand side of your screen. Just click the arrow next to the word questions down towards the bottom, and you can click that arrow, expand the dialog box, and we'll get to your Q&A now. So the first question that came in, Dr. Walker, do you have an impression of proportion of injury die to blast? Injury die to blast? I'm sorry, I think it's supposed to say, do you have an impression of proportion of injury due to blast or due to impact? A rough guess, if not possible.
Primary blast traumatic brain injury is still controversial. To date, it's not been well documented that humans can have a traumatic brain injury from a blast without significant whiplash-type phenomena or head-striking-something phenomena, the so-called secondary blast sequelae. So in almost all cases of the blast interview, the blast TBIs I've seen, they've also been associated with an individual getting knocked to the ground or getting knocked into something. So I guess the answer to the question is we really don't know about that primary blast TBI, whether you can get a TBI just from the overpressurization. There is some animal lab evidence that that can happen, but it really has not been well demonstrated clinically.
Thank you. The next question. Can, quote, seeing stars be defined? Could it be similar to migraine aura symptoms?
Yeah, I wish it could be better defined. I think it's more of a little more of a concrete type of symptom that people have, perhaps because they've seen cartoons, Bugs Bunny or the Roadrunner, and he gets whacked on the head, and then you see the stars circling above him. I oftentimes will ask some alternative kind of lay type of terms, like if I'm not really sure from dazed or confused or seeing stars, if they're hemming and hawing a little bit, I'll ask them if they felt like they had their bell rung, which people, particularly people who've done sports, understand that concept. So whether or not there's actually some true visual phenomenon or it's more just kind of a way for them to express feeling dazed and confused in a little more tangible terms, I think is unknown.
Thank you. And how long after impact would it be expected for a person to see stars, and how long would that be expected to last?
In our experience, it's extremely brief. So most of the patients and research subjects who report it lasts for under 1 minute. So if someone's seeing stars for much longer than that, there's probably something else going on.
Thank you. I believe you said that if someone was dazed or saw stars but was able to continue fighting, he or she probably did not have a TBI. Did I hear that correctly?
I think it all depends on the context. So just showing this video as an example, he got up and actually played the next play, which he turned it over. He fumbled it. So he did, but he wasn't actually playing well. So I think most can probably tell you if they were able to operate at their full faculties or not. So that's what I was alluding to. Sometimes you'll hear the term "my adrenaline kicked in," and I performed right. So something horrific happens, a blast goes off, a buddy may have gotten hurt or even killed nearby. They react to that acute fear or stress reaction, but that's very quick. Boom, the adrenaline then kicks in, and they continue on with their combat mission. So I think that if someone is able to perform at a high level, then it is unlikely that they just had a TBI.
Thank you. We do have four pending questions, but we are nearing the top of the hour. Are you able to stay on and answer these for the recording?
Yes, I can stay on a few more minutes.
Okay, great. If any of our attendees need to drop off at the top of the hour, when you exit the session, please wait while the feedback survey populates on your screen and take just a moment to fill out those few questions. Dr. Sifu, in his CTE presentation last week, stated that symptoms that occur 2 weeks after the event are not related to the TBI event. Do you agree?
I think what he was probably referring to was the diagnostic elements that altered consciousness, it has to be immediate. So there's not a gap. So if someone initially felt very clear, has full recall, was thinking clearly, and then suddenly becomes dazed or confused later on, that is not consistent with TBI, altered consciousness. TBIs improve over time. So sometimes people can actually report symptoms later on that they didn't have earlier because they may not be provoked. So we see this a lot. For example, someone gets a TBI and they're held out of work. They start to recover and then they feel that like they're fine and they go back to work and then they start having problems because they weren't really pushing their brain to work hard. It was only when they started taxing their brain that they started noticing some of those symptoms. So I guess a long answer to a short question is I agree, but so there's a lot of subtleties there that go into that. If that didn't answer the question, I'm happy to follow up further with a follow-up question to that.
Thank you. They're more than welcome to write in for further clarification. Is cervicogenic headache a symptom of TBI? Is it, or is it a headache different from a regular headache post-TBI?
All right, some tough questions. So there is really no specific headache. There is really no TBI-specific headache. With that to say, actually, I've been involved in a lot of post-traumatic headache research, and it looks like the evidence is fairly clear that migraine-type headaches are more common after TBI than they are in the general population. So if anything, we think that there's some specificity of migraine headaches with TBI. So we often will treat, particularly if the headache is episodic and severe, with migraine prophylaxis and abortive medications. Beyond that, we just try to categorize the headache. Cervicogenic headache just refers to headache originating from some problem in the neck. So it's very often associated with a cervical whiplash injury. And cervical whiplash injuries often co-occur with TBI. So we see many patients with both a TBI and a whiplash injury. So their headaches may actually be coming from that whiplash injury. You can also get direct contusions to the scalp and skull or even some nerve damage, like the greater occipital nerve might get banged in a head injury. So there's many potential explanations for head pain after a head or neck injury.
Thank you. What if immediate but not delayed criteria are met?
So the immediate alteration of consciousness means it's contiguous with the traumatic event. There's no gap. There's an epidural hematoma. There's been some high profile cases. I'm blanking on the celebrity who within the past year died of an epidural hematoma, but an epidural hematoma is a tearing of one of the veins underneath the skull, in which case you can get some pretty massive blood buildup underneath the skull, which can then kind of compress the brain and cause death. But that's classic for a lucid what's so-called lucid interval. So a lucid interval means you have an event, you strike your head, and then you're perfectly clear. You're not dazed, you're not confused, you're not unconscious. You don't have a memory gap. You remember it and think clearly. And then all of a sudden there's a delay and you become altered. So that's what we mean by that immediate. It has to be adjacent to the traumatic event. If there's any gap, that's not from diffuse axonal injury. The only exception is you could have the epidural hemorrhage, or sometimes a subdural hemorrhage will do the same thing. But those, again, are not concussions. Those are actually intracerebral hemorrhages.
Thank you. And the final question we have, in the coding and billing world, post-concussive syndrome is coded under mental, behavioral, and neurodevelopmental health category, and it requires a primary physiological diagnosis. Many times, providers just document the post-concussive syndrome and leave out the TBI diagnosis. What is the belief between providers when documenting post-concussive syndrome? Just for clarification, is there a time frame that providers use to assign a diagnosis of post-concussive syndrome or sequela?
So I think that probably what you're seeing is clinicians who I have great respect for, because I am a clinician as well. You've got a patient in your office or clinic, and you're trying to deal with, okay, what's going on? What's he complaining of? What can I do to help them? And so you're not necessarily going to be focused on the original diagnosis, which to some extent becomes more just a technical exercise. You can just say, well, this seems like a lot of TBI symptoms. There was some event which the person had. And so you're essentially just dealing with the present, which what looks like post-concussive syndrome. So you may not put a lot of care and attention and time into going through that element of trying to diagnose that TBI. So I guess I would say there's clinical prioritization probably rather than being pure with your diagnostic terms. So technically, for post-concussive syndrome, you have to have had a TBI. The symptoms have to have begun right away, and the symptoms have to have persisted beyond 3 months. And for post-concussive syndrome, the ICD criteria are at least 3 symptoms. So it could be a headache, dizziness, and irritability, let's say, that last for at least 3 months, and that would get you an ICD diagnosis of post-concussion syndrome.
Thank you. That is the final pending question at this time, but I'd like to give you the opportunity to make any concluding comments you'd like to.
I thank everyone for their interest and attention, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all. It was fun. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and lending your expertise to the field. Ralph, did you want to wrap up with anything?
Well, we'd like to thank Dr. Walker for a very nuanced and subtle diagnostic presentation. We really appreciate his referral to the degrees of uncertainty of some of these and the need for further work. Again, thank you very much, Dr. Walker.
Okay, thank you all.
Thank you.